Hello, John Dennis here on Thursday the 12th of March. Today, Northern Ireland unites against the terrorists.
People like myself who's been through it all, we don't want to go back there. And it's up to people like myself and other people of influence to make sure that young loyalists don't fall into this trap.
Also today, Germany mourns the victims of a teenage gunman who unleashed a bloodbath in his former school.
This is the most ordinary town that you could possibly find. It's a very kind of quiet, commuter-type suburb.
And why climate scientists have warned that we could lose 85% of the Amazon rainforest due to global warming.
Even if we were to get a 2-degree temperature rise, that would still commit us to losing about a third of the Amazon forest. So pretty much whatever we do, massive amounts of the Amazon are going to die.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Bill Overton with the news.
In Ireland, The Guardian has been told by security sources that the authorities are hunting for a bomb prepared by dissident Republicans. Intelligence information has led the security forces to believe that a bomb prepared in the Republic is to be brought to Northern Ireland. Police on both sides of the border have been searching for the bomb since Monday. It's believed to be as much as £300 in weight. Today, the police chiefs of Northern Ireland and the Republic are to meet to discuss the security situation. In Pakistan, lawyers and political activists have begun a protest march on Parliament from across the country. They aim to take part in a sit-in protest because the government hasn't fulfilled its promise to reinstate lawyers sacked by former President Musharraf. The most prominent to be forced out was the country's Chief Justice. The government said that it will disrupt the march, and 400 activists have already been arrested. The opposition leader, Nawaz Sharif, has said that he supports the protest. He's told The Guardian the government is running an elected dictatorship that is plotting to kill him. The French President Nicolas Sarkozy has announced his nation will rejoin NATO's military command. For some time, France has been sending its forces to operate alongside the other members of the European Defence Force. But for decades, since the time of President de Gaulle, the country's leaders have refused to be involved in strategic planning. They argued that NATO was dominated by the USA. Sarkozy says the French have to stop burying their heads in the sand. Lord Laming will publish his review of child protection services in Britain today. After the Baby P case, he was asked to find out how councils had introduced reforms he recommended after his inquiry into the death of Victoria Clombier, also in Haringey. He's expected to say that too many children are still abused because social workers fail to protect them. The Children's Secretary will announce a new training scheme for managers of children's services. Football and a second night of success for English Premiership sides in Europe. Both Manchester United and Arsenal also went through to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. Man U didn't let Jose Mourinho's Inter Milan score a single goal in either leg. Last night they firmly won 2-0 at Old Trafford. Not such an easy night for Arsenal. In Italy, Roma scored the only goal, which left the two sides drawn. Arsenal scraped through on penalties. And it's the football that gives the headline writers most fun on the sports pages of the morning papers. Marching on, United 2 special for Mourinho, says The Telegraph. It's no way Jose in the mail. And over a picture of jubilant goal scorer Ronaldo, The Sun says, special Ron, Cristiano KOs Jose. The Guardian leads on its front page with its story about a suspected bomb in Ireland, but it also reports from the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference that British scientists fear the loss of the Amazon rainforest. We'll hear that full story shortly. The Times reports that a former detainee in Guantanamo who was released is now the Taliban commander responsible for sophisticated bomb attacks on British forces in southern Afghanistan. Following the protest in Luton against a parade of soldiers, the Mail reports that a Muslim preacher has also attacked British troops. Anjem Trowdy is supposed to have said that the troops were not heroes but cowards. The Mail says that it's an insult to the war dead. Finally, The Telegraph believes that an EU ruling to restrict doctors' hours will delay operations on the NHS. It claims that patients will face a significant increase in waiting times. More news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Across Northern Ireland, thousands of people took part in silent vigils yesterday in protest at the recent terrorist murders. Outside Belfast City Hall, the protest was called by the Irish Council of Trade Unions. Esther Adley reports.
You're all very welcome here today. This lunchtime, thousands of citizens are gathering to collectively share some moments of silence. The trade union movement stands together with all citizens in solidarity to prevent any derailment of the peace process. The callous attacks of the last few days were an assault on every citizen who supports peace.
It's difficult to know exactly who everyone is at this kind of gathering, and certainly one of this size, but it's certainly a very much a cross-community event. People from all sides of the community, all walks of life and all different ages. There's elderly men in black coats and flat caps, a young pregnant woman with a child just standing next to me, groups of young people, and obviously many, many older people who remember the Troubles. Do you mind telling me about your banner that you've got?
Really, it just says, "Dear dissidents, hear our plea. Please end this killing spree." I think that speaks for everyone here today. I was born coming out of the Troubles. I never really witnessed it, and I don't want to. Neither does any other people in my age group, you know, in their young 20s. It's not something we want to have to grow up with, you know, bearing the scars of violence. I don't think, you know, I want future generations to have to bear this either. And the other day we seen Peter Robinson and Martin McGuinness walking side by side with Hugh Orde, the PSNI, condemning this. You know, I mean, that's something we've never had before in Northern Ireland, and I think that shows the progress that has been made. And, you know, these attacks by these dissidents isn't going to destabilise the peace process that, you know, people have worked so hard for here in Northern Ireland.
Some people are saying that where there is support for the violence continuing, it's among young people maybe who can't remember the Troubles. I think they say it's quite small, but that's the constituency, or one of the constituencies, where there would be some support. Do you know people, or have you spoken to people who express any sympathy for the continuing violence?
Well, I mean, I know young people who, you know, would consider themselves Republicans and would be not necessarily supporting the stance Sinn Féin has, but I know nobody that would condone this sort of violence. You know, everyone has a right to a political ideology, but nobody has a right to commit violence and murder, especially whenever you're attacking a peace process that people have worked so hard for in Northern Ireland. It's not something that's going to be destabilised by these sort of attacks.
Just tell me about who you are and what your banner says.
I'm Jonathan Galway Jackson, loyalist from East Belfast, and the banner is which says "Combined Loyalists for Peace." It's designed to show that the loyalist community is here for peace and peace alone, and will not be deflected off our own peace strategy set up by David Irvine, Billy Mitchell, Gusty Spence, Frankie Gallagher, and the rest of the loyalists. We will not be put off track by a couple of idiots with a couple of guns who've struck lucky at the weekend.
One of those present at the rally was Jackie McDonald, who leads the loyalist UDA. He said that he had taken two young lads aged of about 11 up to Antrim to pay their respects to the two dead soldiers.
People like myself who's been through it all, we don't want to go back there. And it's up to people like myself and other people of influence to make sure that young loyalists don't fall into this trap. You know, it's nothing glorious about it. There's nothing sexy about it. It's just death and destruction, prison. All the downside that they have to look at too. You know, the loyalist community and the nationalist community, the Republicans, nobody wants this. Only a handful of idiots. We are better than this. Why should we get sucked into something that we fought 35 years and more against? Republicanism. This isn't Republicanism. These fellas aren't Republicans. They're just glorified gangsters, you know, trying to break down the whole system. That's working well for us all.
Esther Adley reporting, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/UK/Northern Ireland. Also on The Guardian's website today, Tanya Gold gives up modern technology for a week and lives like it's 1989 at guardian.co.uk/technology. Was Queen Charlotte Britain's first black queen? Asks Stuart Jeffries at guardian.co.uk/UK. And how Nicolas Sarkozy plans to redesign Paris with the help of architects including Richard Rogers. Read about that at guardian.co.uk/France. Germany is in mourning today after a 17-year-old gunman referred to by police as Tim K went on a killing spree yesterday at his former school. The attack began in Winnenden, a town of about 27,000 residents near Stuttgart in southern Germany, from where The Guardian's Lizzie Davis reports.
It looks like one 17-year-old boy who used to be a member of the Realschule, that's a secondary school in Winnenden, entered the school at around about 9:30 and began to shoot, police say, indiscriminately. He shot dead 9 pupils, 3 teachers, and somehow, this is what we're trying to find out, managed to escape from the school, shoot another passerby dead on the way, hijacked a car, kidnapped the driver, drove 40 kilometres to a nearby town where he was then, at around about midday, caught by police in a shootout in the middle of the street. 2 policemen injured, 2 other passersby caught up in the violence, shot dead, and then finally the gunman shot dead himself.
Do we know, Lizzie, whether the gunman took his own life or whether he died from a police gunshot?
That hasn't been confirmed. I think we're meant to assume that it happened in the course of gunfire exchange with the police, but there has been no kind of confirmed information that it was a suicide, which is, of course, the normal thing in these kind of shootings. The previous shootings in America and in Germany end up usually with the shooter shooting himself on site, so it was already unusual that he hadn't done that in the school.
Well, as you said, I mean, tragedies such as these are depressingly familiar, but how unusual is something like this in Germany?
Not as unusual as, say, it would be in Britain. There have been 2 notable cases in recent years. The most deadly was in 2002, when 17 people were shot dead by a school shooter. Then more recently than that, several years later, there were a dozen or so injured in a similar incident. But this is by far the most fatal in terms of numbers for a good number of years.
This gunman's killing spree began in his former school. Do we know what motivated this attack?
We know very little about him, in fact. We know that he was an only child, that his father was a wealthy businessman from the area. We understand that he was dissatisfied about exam results, that he was worried about impending exams. But this is all hearsay. The police are being very, very reticent about giving out any details.
Lizzie, you've been speaking to a few people in Winnenden. It's only a small town. What's the atmosphere like?
Total shock, absolute total shock. This is the most ordinary town that you could possibly find. It's a very kind of quiet, commuter-type suburb on the outskirts of Stuttgart, been thrown into complete confusion by the awful events of this morning. I've spoken to a good number of people, and the most common thing they are saying to me almost repeatedly is, I cannot believe something like this would happen in a place like this. There's a real sense of shock. Something as extraordinary could happen in as ordinary a place.
And how easy is it to get guns in Germany?
It is reasonably easy. After the mass shooting in Erfurt in 2002, the police raised the level for gun ownership from 18 to 21 with the idea that would put people off and it would make it harder. But we have it on confirmed information that this boy who was involved in this shooting owned a considerable number of guns, or at least his family owned a lot of guns in their house. So it looks like he'd managed to procure one of those weapons and use it to deadly effect.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Lizzie Davis. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, how China's massive tree planting scheme is being undermined by the country's insatiable desire for wood.
China is trying to reverse deforestation and make money at the same time. One solution is this, the nation's first national park. Since it was selected last year, Tang Wanghe is a flagship for Heilongjiang, which wants tourists to fill the space left in the economy.
But first, global warming will wreck attempts to save the Amazon rainforest. That's according to a devastating new study by the Met Office, which predicts that 1/3 of the Amazon's trees will be killed by even modest rises in temperature. The findings of the study were presented at a climate change conference in Copenhagen. Environment correspondent David Adam is there.
This year is a very big one politically for climate change. Also in Copenhagen at the end of the year, the politicians are going to get together and try and hammer out a new global climate deal to try and put limits on carbon emissions. And the scientists are concerned that, firstly, that perhaps their message isn't getting through because the politicians haven't done enough, and secondly, that perhaps even that message is slightly out of date because the most authoritative study on climate change was produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, in 2007. But that took a few years to pull together, so pretty much anything that's been published in the last 4 or 5 years isn't in the IPCC. And so a lot of the scientists say, well, a lot's changed in those 4 or 5 years, especially on areas like what might happen to sea level. And so it's only fair that the scientists tell the politicians the most up-to-date information.
Now, the Met Office has been reporting its research into how global warming affects deforestation of the Amazon. Can you tell us what the report says?
Sure. Well, I mean, this is a genuine scientific meeting. This isn't really designed for the press. And one of the scientists described this as a bombshell in the session to the other scientists. That gives you an idea of just how serious it is. They've looked at what's going to happen to the Amazon rainforest as temperatures rise. Now, we've known for a while, or we've thought for a while, that there'll be something called dieback, which is, crudely, climate change causes less rainfall in the Amazon, which affects the trees, brings on a bit of a drought. That in itself then has another effect on rainfall in the region, and the whole sort of area gets locked into a vicious circle, which ultimately ends with the trees dying because there isn't enough water. So we've known that's happened. We know that might happen for a while, but what they've done now is to try and put numbers and to quantify what might happen. And what they've found is huge losses of the Amazon. So I suppose the take-home number is that even if we were to stabilize climate change with a 2-degree rise, which is pretty ambitious, and a lot of the scientists here would say we can't do that, but that's what we're officially aiming for. Even if we were to get a 2-degree temperature rise, that would still commit us to losing about a third of the Amazon forest. So pretty much whatever we do, massive amounts of the Amazon are going to die.
And David, obviously 2-degree rise is an ambitious target. What happens if we get a 3-degree rise?
Well, it gets a lot worse, unfortunately. I mean, we should say this is one model. The Hadley Center, sorry, the Met Office, very well-respected institution, but this is, you know, it's one computer simulation. It's not a prediction. It's just what they think might happen. But a 3-degree rise would cause so much drought that we're looking at 3/4 of the Amazon might die.
David Adam. China is the world's largest emitter of carbon. It's also got one of the world's largest tree planting schemes. But the country's insatiable desire for wood has had a disastrous impact on its forests and biodiversity, as our Asia environment correspondent Jonathan Watts reports from China's first national park in Tangwanhe.
In China's frozen northern frontier of Heilongjiang, tree trunks get turned into toothpicks amid a clanking, mist-shrouded workshop. The wood is soaked, stripped and fed into a peeler. Every 10 seconds, a thick log is reduced to pick thin strips. A whole tree is consumed every 5 minutes. In total, this small factory has shredded close to 1 million trees. Multiply that several thousandfold, and you get an idea of how much wood is consumed by China's paper mills, flooring firms, and timber yards. But this factory is having to change as a result of a new government plan to rebuild the nation's forests. Bordering Siberia, the temperatures here fall below minus 30 degrees. This area was once known as the Great Northern Wilderness. Today, it's a land of lumberjacks. More than 90% of Heilongjiang's original forest has been felled in the past 60 years. It's one of the fastest rates of deforestation in human history. The loggers have been told it's no longer sustainable.
Now,
China is trying to reverse deforestation and make money at the same time. One solution is this, the nation's first national park. Since it was selected last year, Tang Wanghe is a flagship for Heilongjiang, which wants tourists to fill the space left in the economy. Logging will be phased out within 3 years. Locals are being compensated or given new jobs, such as this man, who must unblock the river every day. The tourist chief says residents have been told the switch to a national park will make them rich. The park has also adopted a scheme for people to adopt Korean pines. It costs 100 yuan for life.
This is typical all over China. The country is planting more trees than anywhere else in the world. It also has more nature reserves than anywhere else in the world. But at the moment, they're just numbers. The fact is, most conservationists say biodiversity in China is declining.
Most of China's new trees are farmed in thin, straggly lines. The forests are increasingly empty. The demand is just too great. It's the same for meat, vegetables and fish. Local markets like this are small, but replicated 100,000-fold, they add up to a vast and growing Chinese appetite for resources. Logging may be banned, but as at this frozen river border with Russia, people will still find a way to cut nature down to size.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
Chris Tarrant's fronted many successful shows over the years, from Tiswas to his long-running breakfast programme on Capital Radio. But he's probably best known for hosting Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, a format so successful it was the basis for the Oscar-winning movie Slumdog Millionaire. He told The Guardian's Hannah Poole about his new show, The Colour of Money.
You have 20 machines of different colours. They all have genuine, real money inside. And after each show, the machine has to be reloaded and different money put, whatever, and great sort of guerrilla security men come in with, it's real, you know, serious stuff. And we're all thrown out of the studio, so nobody, including me, knows what money goes where. The machines hold anything between £1,000 and £20,000, one of each. And they choose 10 colours for various reasons. People's reasons for choosing colours were quite interesting. I mean, they really vary. They choose 10 colours, one at a time. And they have to get, they find an amount they're going to play for. It might be £85,000 or whatever at the very beginning. They then say, right, I've got 10 machines to find that amount of money. It will be in there. It will be in the machines. And they go, okay, start the machine. And as soon as the machine starts, it just goes 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. And this is when the audience and the friends start going, stop, for God's sake, stop, no more, don't be greedy, whatever. 5,000. I mean, it's just surreal. And they have to get up to, yeah, whatever the amount is, £80,000 or whatever. So it's not millionaire money, but it's proper money, for God's sake. You know, it's real. And it clearly matters to them hugely. And it just becomes incredibly tense. The great thing about this for me is that there is absolutely no in-between. You know, you get the full amount or nothing, which does make it quite brutal. I mean, it's unlike Millionaire, where you can go, oh yeah, Chris, I've had a lovely day and I've been on the telly and I've met you and I've got 20 grand and I'm going home, I can't stand any more of this.
Have you seen the film?
The guy, the host, what's he called? Whatever he's called.
Well, he's called Prem, the show. But
yeah, Mr. Bollywood.
Yeah.
He sat through, poor sod, he sat through hours of me. But then, when I watched it, I had a sort of different viewpoint probably from anyone else in the world. I enjoyed it, I did enjoy it. I'm not just saying that. I mean, there's lots of mates of mine involved in it, and you know, I'm delighted. I mean, for God's sake, from a little piler 11 years ago in Elstree to suddenly walking down the carpet with the Oscars is like, what? You know, it's unreal. But I did find myself concentrating on the host and the show more than the story a lot. It's kind of inevitable because it's what I've done for so long.
How do you think he did it?
Well, I thought he was a bit of a sleaze, wasn't he? You know, with his earring. I mean, I'm not sure about him, frankly. Yeah, I'm sure he's a very nice man. But see, the other thing, I mean, how absurd is this? I'm sorry, but no way in, you know, 11 years, 500 and odd shows or whatever, a millionaire, have I ever taken a contestant to the bog. And I don't know why. I've never done that. And I probably never will.
You've missed a trick, obviously.
I don't think so. To tell them the answer to the next question. I've never done that. Trust me. I've never done that.
This isn't millionaire money, as you said. Uh-huh. Is that the credit crunch in action? Was that a very specific decision to make it sort of... Because it does... It's strange. It's significantly less money than... Uh-huh. Than was available in a millionaire.
No, it's not credit crunch. I think it would be kind of weird. It would be exciting. It would be kind of weird, really, to just choose 10 colours at random and win £1 million. I mean, I've always been very, very much against the sort of GMTV, Richard and Judy, Phil and Fern sort of competitions they do, where it's like, how many C's are there in cat? Is it A, 1, B, 2? Well done, you've won a holiday for 4 in Hawaii. I've always found that kind of ridiculous. So now, I mean, we would not want to go there. I think £1 million would be kind of extreme. I think that would be, you know, a bit silly, wouldn't it?
Chris Tarrant talking to Hannah Poole. Peter Sale and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily, and my name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.